Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I'm Josh Beiser, and tonight we have a special cast because we are talking to a developer who currently has a Kickstarter going on. Normally, we've spoken to developers after their Kickstarter to get the results, but this time we're doing it during the middle. So please welcome to the cast from Human Nature Studios, as well as the co-creator behind the cult classic series Toe Jam and Earl, Greg Johnson.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, Greg. It's a pleasure to have you on the cast.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I'm always happy to talk about Toe Jam and Earl.
Yeah. And Toe Jam and Earl, in my spotlight that I posted a week ago, was one of my favorite games growing up. And for those of you listening to the cast right now, Greg is in the middle of his Kickstarter to bring the series back with Toe Jam and Earl back in the groove. And by the time you hear this cast, the Kickstarter should only have a few days left. And at this time of recording, you guys have gone over the halfway point. So it looks like you guys are hopefully on track to make it.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, it's right now it looks like it's going to be close. Mm-hmm. So I'm, of course, optimistic, and I think we'll make it. And there's an awful lot of enthusiasm, and a lot of the fans are kind of rallying with their support. So I can't see us not making it. But then again, you know how it is. You're just kind of a little nerve-wracking.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we're going to talk more about Back in the Groove later in the cast. But to get things rolling, for people who may not have heard of you, Greg, or Human Nature Studios, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in the game industry?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. It's a long story, but I'll try to condense it just because I have been in the game industry for kind of ever. I started way back in around 1981 in the industry when I just graduated college. I went to UCSD, got my degree in biolinguistics. Mm-hmm. I wanted to speak with the dolphins and talk to the aliens. That was my my plan when the aliens landed. I was really interested in language and communication and the brain and all that. So I ended up just kind of building aliens to talk to, I guess. My very first game out of college was called Starflight. It was one of EA's very early games. And it was originally for the Atari 800 and the Commodore 64. And then we went, moved over to the Tandy computer. I don't know if anybody listening is old enough to remember those machines. But then on to the PC. That was in the days when, before people actually played games on PCs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that long time ago.
That's right. It makes me feel really, really old. It's a little painful, but I'll try to enjoy it. It's history. And I've been making games ever since then as an independent game developer, made lots and lots of games, and I've worked on games from other people. So I did, Starflight 1 and 2, and I did Caveman Uglympics and Orly's Draw, A Story, Broderbund, and in more recent years, I've worked on Kung Fu Panda World for DreamWorks, and I did, of course, Doki Doki Universe with Sony pretty recently on the PlayStation 3 and 4 and the PS Vita. And I contributed to Paul Ritchie and Fred Ford's Star Control, Star Control 2. Those were really fun old garage shop days when I was working on Starflight and Paul was helping me, and then we flipped it around and I helped them on Star Control. And Spore and with Will Wright, and Sims 2 also worked on those as well.
Cool. I'm a big fan of the Star Control series, and I would love to spend a lot of time with you on that, but I know your time is limited, and we could spend, 2-3 hours just talking about those games. I have a friend who's big into science fiction and a lot of the spaceship-type games. I know he would just go gaga talking to you about Starflight.
No, great. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, man, it's amazing, as just a quick aside, being able to talk to developers like yourself who have been around the industry for so long. I mean, I remember growing up playing games like Toe Jam and Earl, Star Control, and this was, back in the day where you really couldn't get a hold of developers to talk to them. And, you know, in today's market and the industry, it's amazing just how readily available you can talk to developers in the indie sector compared to back then or even in the AAA.
Yeah, you know, that actually goes both ways. I don't know. This is probably something that fans wouldn't even ever really think about. But as a developer, you know, you historically, we've been kind of isolated. You know, you get instructions by your publisher and you get funded and you go off in a corner and build your game and then it goes out there. In the old days, you might see a few reviews in some hard copy magazines and you didn't really have any way to reach the fans or even know what they thought. Yeah. And that was always kind of a frustration, and you always just were, it was always kind of an almost an anticlimax when you work for a year or two and then released a game, and then you just kind of wondered what people thought. And of course, you get to see the numbers for how well it sells or doesn't sell, but that's not the same thing as hearing from people all those sort of personal stories, what it means to them and what they liked and didn't like. So these days, it's very different, and it's really great from the developer's perspective, too.
Yeah, and definitely an interesting point, Greg, about the past. I mean, when you talk about a lot of the classic game series and a lot of the best games that people grew up with, most people really don't know, you know, the men and women behind those games. Now, obviously, like, big names like Sid Meier and Shigeru Miyamoto, but unless you're, like, making, like, those multi-million dollar games, most people will never find out who you are that made one of their favorite cult classics.
Yeah, I guess you're right about that. And most game developers are kind of anonymous, and it's a little different than other art forms, you know, music or movies or even authors of books. But I don't know a lot of game developers personally that really aspire to that kind of celebrity status anyway. I think most of us are really driven by just wanting to make, because we love, we're in it because we love the games, and we just want to make something fun to play, and we want people to enjoy it. Don't really care. I personally don't care if my name is out there, and in fact, it's been a little weird and sometimes even a little uncomfortable for me recently to have to be so public and to have doing all these podcasts and interviews and just like, here's Greg Johnson, listen to Greg Johnson talk again. And it just, it just feels odd. I'm not used to it at all.
Yeah, I hear you with that, Greg. I mean, I've spoken with a few friends on this cast previously. I mean, back in high school and college, I was basically 10 for 10 on, like, the introverted scale. And now, these days, I'm doing weekly podcasts, daily Let's Plays, talking basically to myself while playing a game and talking to people like you. And it is such a weird feeling trying to be a public face when you were never that way in the past. And as you said, Greg, a lot of developers aren't aspiring to be, you know, these mega celebrities. They just want to make great games. And it's weird, you know, having to put that social face on and, as you said, do interviews, do podcasts, and so on.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the thing I enjoy about it the most really is all of the one-on-one conversations that I get to have. So I'm getting just a ton of private messages through our Facebook page and through Kickstarter and now through email as well. And I've met so many people and I've heard so many stories, and I'm trying to the problem with Kickstarter, though, is it's like, it's so great, but it's all at once.
Yeah.
You know, it's just all condensed into a very short span of time. So I get kind of inundated and I want to talk to everybody, and that's very difficult, but, you know, it's great too.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about the Kickstarter and some of your thoughts on the platform later on the cast. But I figure we could really just sit here and talk a lot about your classic series in the industry, and I don't want to keep you too long. So let's talk about the series that I'm interested in today, and that is Toe Jam and Earl. So Toe Jam and Earl was a game that was for Sega Genesis back in 91, I believe.
That's right.
And very interesting title. I was reading an interview or a feature on Polygon where they talked about the design of the game, and they talked about how it really had, or I think you said, it had a lot of roguelike elements to it, which I found very fascinating because, again, this was back in 91. Roguelikes on the consoles were unheard of, and they remain unheard of until probably, like, Demon's Souls, like, a few years ago.
So, yeah.
So I guess my first question then for you, Greg, is what was the inspiration or the motivation to create Toe Jam and Earl?
Yeah, you know, it's funny that term roguelike didn't used to exist.
Yeah.
It's been around for maybe 10 years or something. And when I made Toe Jam and Earl, there was no concept of roguelike. The only thing that was out there was Rogue.
Yeah.
That was it. That was just the Rogue game. There's only one game of Rogue. And it was, there were no consoles even when I started. You know, they were just getting going. I remember when the whole idea of the console came out, I remember seeing my first Atari and Commodore 64, and I was amazed. But even prior to that, I just played Rogue on the school, on my university's mainframe computer. And, you know, the old days when we had computer terminals and the computer was somewhere else and you were played on an ASCII, you know, black and white screen. And that's how I played it. And I even, this was even old at the time, but I still had like stacks of Fortran cards that I would put into the card reader machine.
Nice.
You know? I'm not ancient, but it was when the era that I kind of came from. And so I think it may be that Toe Jam and Earl was one of the very first Rogue spin-offs, because at the time all I remember was I love that game Rogue, I love the mechanics, I want more of it, and I want to make a game like that so that I can play more of it. And then a couple years later after that, Diablo came out.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at that and going, oh, look, somebody else likes Rogue too. That's a Rogue remake, only they didn't even bother to change it. They went straight up the same characters, same magic spells, same everything. And I remember feeling like, wait a second, how can they get away with that? Clearly they did, and I'm sure they added a lot of their own spice to it. But, you know, mm-hmm. It was thematically kind of straight up. So
yeah.
Long answer there for you.
Yep. And it's interesting to talk about how Rogue originally was just the game that sort of spawned the genre. It reminds me a lot of how the Metroidvania genre has sort of taken root after Castlevania Symphony of the Night, and how it was just one game and it just really inspired that entire genre. But that's a whole nother can of worms mm-hmm. there. So
yeah, you're right.
So with Toe Jam and Earl, another part of the game that I found interesting was the fact that it was multiplayer, specifically co-op split screen. And for the life of me, I can't remember if this was the first game that did that or if it was one of the first games that had that co-op functionality in it.
You know, it's not the first game that was a co-op game by any
yeah.
means. But as far as I know, it was the first game that ever did that split screen thing. Certainly the first game that did the dynamic split screen.
Yeah.
I had never seen it before, and it just seemed like a good idea at the mm-hmm. time. And I asked Mark if we could do that, Mark Vorsanger, who was the co-creator of Toe Jam and Earl, I'm sure you know, and he was the engineer, and he didn't have a clue. He said, I don't know, but I'll try if you think you want that. And I said, great.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, and I've always been surprised that I haven't seen more of that. I know it's been in a few games, but I don't know why it hasn't been kind of picked up and used more, because it sure works well.
Yeah, you know? It does. And for those of you listening who don't know what we're talking about, in the original Toe Jam and Earl, when both players were on the screen at the same time or shared the same screen information, the game stayed with the single screen focus. But when either character moved off or started to get off that screen, instead of locking both players to a screen, the game would just basically cut the screen in half and display the top player on one end, bottom player, and they could basically wander the entire level at their own free will, and then when they would come back together, the screen would, you know, collapse again, would be a single screen of focus. And as you said, it's kind of interesting that no one else or very few people have copied that, considering a lot of 2D games that we're seeing in like the revival of the genre among the indie developers these days.
Yeah, I think that's probably in part too, just because there still aren't a whole lot of multiplayer cooperative games. I mean, there's definitely that's grown a lot, but that kind of has to be a big priority of yours if you're gonna, you know, work on doing that dynamic split screen and put the resources towards that. And I guess there's, you know, you can look at that long list of roguelikes out there, and some of them, a few of them are designed with co-op in mind, but an awful lot of them aren't. So,
yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah, it's a good question.
Yep. Now, another part of what made Toad General so fascinating and popular was the aesthetics, especially the character designs and the music, which I know a lot of fans like. I still hum the Toe Jam and Earl theme song sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
What was the inspiration behind the music and sort of the art style for the game?
Oh, well, I guess a couple things. It just happened because I loved that kind of music, and that's what I listened to.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just sort of natural that, and that's what happens with most developers. Tim Schafer loves rock and roll, so he does what was the game with Jack Black?
Brutal Legend.
Brutal Legend, right. And we all do what we love, and so that was part of it. And then it was also because it just sort of sprang out of the characters of Toe Jam and Earl. They were in their inception, they just popped out of my head as orange and red aliens, but really under their alien skin, they're kind of like African American, bros, because they're like, yo, what's up? This is my homeboy, Big Earl. Yo, I'm Big Earl. What's up? And I wanted them to be cool. They were just, and to me, that's what cool kind of is, you know. And then and the funk and kind of that laid back feeling of, of just funky music and dancing and the friendship between them, you know, and the kind of that brotherhood. And I'm a half and half kid, half white, half black.
Mm-hmm.
That's been kind of in the media a little bit these days because I've talked about it, I think, before. And as people have asked me, where did Toe Jam and Earl come from and why are the characters like that? And that's, I think that's partly why that makes such a connection for me.
Okay.
So, so to answer your question, that's all, it's all kind of tied up together as to where it comes from and why it's like that with all of the funk and the funky music and that style. And then the art style, at the time, it was just everything was, 8 or 9 pixels tall. The art style was just kind of what it was because I'm not an artist, and I did most of that art myself, just sort of pushing pixels around with Deluxe Paint. You remember that program?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We worked on the Amiga, Dan Silva's Deluxe Paint. It was a great tool. And and the bright colors just felt right, I guess, because the whole experience was intended to be just cheerful and uplifting and fun and kind of happy. So I never really thought about it very much. It just kind of came out that way.
Okay. Now, another part of what made Toe Jam and Earl so fascinating, especially as being a early console game, was the difficulty. The game was on the harder side, partly because of the rogue, or we probably just like rogue elements of the game with the randomly generated levels, and the fact that there wasn't a specific end level. You just had to keep playing until you found all the spaceship parts. When you were balancing and basically fine-tuning the gameplay, where did the decision come from to make it more on like the harder end or more closer to a rogue in general?
You know, actually, there is an end level. There's 25 levels. But that's interesting because it sounds like you probably didn't get to the last level, which is not surprising. A lot of people didn't. And in those days, it was one of the just the way the Sega Genesis worked. There was no way, easy way to save your game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you could put in a really, really long code. And I think in Toe Jam and Earl 1, you couldn't even do that.
Mm-hmm.
So what that meant was that a lot of people never made it to the end of the game. Or I've heard a lot of stories recently that people telling me that, I never made it to the end back when I was a kid, and we tried for years and years, and I finally did, like, you know, a decade or two later. But anyway, yeah, the original Rogue game, you don't really know how deep in the dungeon goes, and that's part of the mystery and part of the appeal. And in Toe Jam and Earl, I remember talking with Mark and thinking about whether or not we would put a limit to it or not, but we felt like we wanted an ending and wanted to give people some sense of closure. And because it's randomly generated world, you can replay it again and again, and it's different each time. So we did do that, but we did set the bar at the time. What felt like it was kind of high. We wanted it to be pretty hard at the upper levels so that people would have that rogue-like feeling of it taking them a while to ever get there. Mm-hmm. But these days, I've heard from a number of people that they feel like the game was too easy.
Yeah, but you always get people like that, even with the hardest games. But yet, it's interesting that you said that Toe Jam Earl only had 25 levels, because that actually leads into the story that I was going to tell you about when I played with my mom back in the day. So, as you said, Greg, Toe Jam Earl was on the hard end. A lot of people couldn't beat it. So I had friends come over, I had cousins, relatives, and none of them could beat it. And then one day, I saw, you know, my mom's here, I'll just have her be, you know, like a co-op buddy. And on that day, I still don't know how we did that. I can't remember, but we did beat the game. I guess it was only 25 floors. I just remember getting that final piece. I could never do it again. Mm. It was just that one All right. time that we beat it. I remember getting the ending scene when you explore Funkatron. I
was like, well, power to your mom. That's impressive.
Yeah, and oh, yeah, she still brings that up. Whenever I talk about, like, games and playing, goes, oh, yeah, well, I beat Toe Jam and Earl. I go, we beat Toe Jam and Earl. I just remember seeing that screen going, I don't want to turn the system off because I don't know where I will get back to this point.
Yeah, well, next time you talk to your mom, congratulate her for me. That's impressive.
Yeah, and again, it was just such a fun experience. I can't remember how we did it, though. That's the funny part. It's been so long, but I just cannot remember how we actually beat that game. And it's just
fun. Well, I'm going to guess it was good teamwork. That must
I
be
hope so.
Because that's worth an awful lot in that game.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a resource management game, and knowing when to split up and when to come to each other's aid, it makes all the difference. But you probably just got some good luck too.
Yeah.
That's the part of what makes random games so fun and unpredictable. It's just a dice roll every time you play.
Yeah. Now, moving on and talking more about the Toe Jam and Earl series, before we get to the Kickstarter, obviously there were a few more games in Toe Jam and Earl. The second game was completely different in tone and style. It was a 2D platformer and didn't have the roguelike elements to it. And I know in one of the interviews you gave, you talked about having to change that design. But for people listening who may not have caught that, could you tell us a little bit about what happened with the Toe Jam and Earl games with the second and third one in the series?
Yeah, sure. I imagine some people have heard this already, but as you said, but what happened was we started in on a sequel to game one. We got about 3 or 4 months in to that. We had gotten in some new terrains, like some ice and snow, I remember, and some walls for kind of mazes that we had randomly generating. And we were working on caves and going like interior spaces. And that's when Sega contacted us, said, hey, sales are not so good on Toe Jam and Earl. It had gotten off to kind of a slow start. It eventually did okay, but in the beginning they were slow. And they said, we think it's because our market doesn't really understand this game, and we don't really know how to market it effectively. We're all about side-scrollers, big characters, and action, and we think our audience wants more of that. So could you do the next Toe Jam and Earl game like that? And we, you know, we went back and forth for a little bit, explained to them we'd have to sort of retool and start all over again, and were they sure they really wanted that, and would they be able to give us more support if we did that way? And we felt like, you know, it just wasn't worth going down that road at the time if Sega wasn't going to be behind it. So we switched, shifted gears, and then all of a sudden we had a challenge for how do we take the spirit of Toe Jam and Earl, which is really two-player exploration and discovery and surprise and put that into an action platformer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you've played Panic on Funkatron, you know the results. And we hid stuff all over with those hidden presents, and we made those chains of buttons and coin meters and, secret, lots and lots of secrets. And we put in the hyperfunk zone and bouncing on fungus and swimming underwater and sliding on the snow and riding on the bubbles and all these different things that we tried to make it really varied so that it wasn't just jumping and shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And then we used the opportunity to work with a really good artist, Kirk Henderson, and show off their, we thought it would be really fun to show their home world, you know, because the original sequel was going to be just set on Earth again. And now we thought, oh, hey, if we're going to be able to get in close with the camera and show big characters, let's show off what Toe Jam and Earl's world looks like. That would be really fun. And then we found this amazingly talented young guy named Evan Wells, who joined us to build levels, because now it was no longer randomly generated. We had a lot of level building to do. Mark created a tool, and Evan sat next to me, and we each built levels, and then we played each other's levels. Evan, these days, you may or may not know, he runs Naughty Dog,
which,
of course, he's very successful. And that's in large part due to the fact that Evan is just an unusually talented, an amazing person. He's great. So we, that was a lot of fun. So with that game was kind of the four of us, me and Mark and Evan and Kirk.
Interesting. And then you went on to do the third game, and that was on the Xbox. And that one sort of went back to the tone or the style of the original one, but I know a lot of people found it a little bit polarizing in terms of its design or some of the design decisions.
Yeah, well, I don't want to... This is a tricky thing, both kind of politically and even ethically, because I don't want to blame anybody else, and I certainly don't want to point a finger, and I may have even done too much of that already, but the truth and the reality of it is, it wasn't the game that we set out to make or that I really wanted to make at the time. We had some dictates from our publisher, Sega, and they, with the best of intentions, they have to do what they think is right for to be responsible for the money they're spending. And it's a lot of money. It's millions of dollars. And so, you kind of have to respect that. But they, 3/4 of the way through the project, they came to us and said, hey, we think what you're doing is too old school. We don't want the stacked levels. We don't want you to be able to die in the game anymore. We want you to add bosses and keys and mini games and cinematic sequences and collectibles and on and on and on. They gave us a whole list of stuff, and they said, here's some games we want you to study. We want it to be like this. And I was kind of floored. Can you imagine? You're like 6 months away from being finished with your game, and your publisher comes in and tells you, hey, we want a different game. And it's tricky. You know, I just wrote an article for Gamma Sutra about that and the developer's dilemma and how you deal with that, because you kind of either are going to be a prima donna and start stomping your feet and saying no. You know, it's actually not that unusual of a situation for a developer to find themselves in, because the publishers are risking a lot of their money, and they care a lot, obviously, about whether or not the game is heading in a direction that they think is marketable.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes they will step in during development and ask you to change direction. Sometimes those are really significant changes. And in this case, with Toe Jam and Earl 3, it was. And it can be difficult as a developer, because you find yourself with a choice of either acting like a prima donna, where you're going to stamp your feet and say, no, I want to make the game I want to make, and I don't care.
Yeah.
or you can understand their perspective and try to do your best, but then you also feel like you're not being true to your vision and to, even in this case, what the fans want and expect. And, and then you feel like you're maybe going to regret it later. And eventually, too, you know, you never want to be pointing the finger. And when people are unhappy, you even at the time, I knew I was going to be taking heat from fans and from reviewers for diverting from what Toe Jam & Earl was. Because they don't know, you know, and they don't really know what happens behind the scenes. Yeah. And if, because a publisher says you should do this or whatever. So it can be a little stressful, you know, but ultimately the people who write the checks call the shots. That's the rule. And when you sign a contract with a publisher and you take their money to build a game, you kind of have to be ready for that, mm-hmm. you know, part of the deal.
Yeah. And as you said, Greg, a lot of the inner workings of the game industry are unknown to a lot of people. And it's one of the things that I really find fascinating, talking to developers like yourself and to other members who've had that experience, because it's not something that is readily known. And I bet people who are enthusiasts or looking to step into the industry would be interested by that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's a really good observation, you know, that and it's sort of like, be warned.
Yeah.
You know, it's not what you think. You don't get to just go have somebody hand you millions of dollars and then you get to go make whatever you want to make. It very rarely is like that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a constant matter of being, you know, political kind of and flexible and compromising and trying to be an advocate for what you believe and winning the respect of the people who are paying for it. And then, you know, really listening to them and doing your best to sort of take the suggestions that you're getting. Oftentimes those suggestions are coming from executives who have just heard, you know, 10 minutes of a pitch of the game, and that's all they know. They haven't even looked at the builds that you've been doing, mm-hmm. or read the design docs, and you get these dictates for what you need to do, and you have to sort of figure out how you're going to incorporate it so that they feel like they're getting what they want, but you're still doing justice to the game and delivering something that you believe in. So it's, you know, it's not always easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an interesting point you brought up, Greg, about how a lot of AAA development, especially today, is controlled by the people who write the checks, about the people who want to get the most bang for their buck. And that opens up a whole nother argument about what has happened with the AAA market and about why a lot of developers have moved to the indie space, where they do have the freedom and control to do whatever they want and make the games that they feel are the best at what they can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. In fact, there are rare exceptions to this, but generally speaking, there's a direct correlation between and maybe even an inverse relationship between the amount of control, creative control you have as a game developer and the amount of money that's being spent on the game. So mm-hmm. to say that a different way, the more money that the game costs, the less control you can expect to have. And that's understandable, right? There's a lot of money at risk. So yeah. The people spending that money, they don't want to take chances. And usually their guiding principle for making their decisions is what has sold before. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very difficult to innovate on a big budget. If you want to innovate and you want to do new things, you want to step out and try stuff nobody has done before, you almost always have to do that on a very small budget. And that can constrain you, you know, it's sort of, it's not always bad. It's, you know, a lot of wonderful, wonderful things are done in the indie space, but there are certain things you can't do on a small budget,
mm-hmm.
You know, but that's kind of just the way it works. Unless you happen to be lucky enough to have a, you know, like
yeah.
a wealthy benefactor who's like going to say, here's, to go do whatever you want and I'll leave you alone. I don't think I know anybody. I haven't heard it. Everybody dreams of that, but I don't know anyone who's had that.
Yeah, definitely. And again, we could sit here and spend the next hour talking about that. And I hate to keep pushing us along, but I know your time is busy. But yeah, we're coming with so many great topics that we could probably turn into just future podcast discussions. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, let's do that. I'm always happy to come back and talk more about this stuff. And you're right, there is kind of an endless amount of stuff to talk about in the game industry.
Definitely. That's pretty much why I really want to do these podcasts, because as we said, there is so many great topics and discussions there that either other developers would like to listen to or people who are just really excited about game design in the industry would love to know. Okay, now one final, I guess, Toe Jam and Earl related question about the early days, or more about like the inner workings of it, and then we'll move on to the Kickstarter.
Okay. And
one thing that I was really interested about that was mentioned on the Kickstarter itself was the fact that you were able to reacquire the rights to Toe Jam and Earl. Or for those of you listening, that means that you were given the rights to basically make the game. Like, it's now your ownership. And I was just wondering, you know, if it's too private or NDA related, you don't have to, but was there anything like interesting or challenging behind reacquiring the rights from Sega for Toe Jam and Earl?
Oh, yeah, I can talk about it at a high level. We didn't reacquire the rights. We never didn't have the rights.
Okay.
Yeah, ever since the very beginning, Mark Vorsanger and I owned the property. That's always been the case. It's been licensed to Sega.
Okay.
Had a series of contracts with them where they had exclusive rights to, market the games that we developed. So that's why you never saw it anywhere else, because that's, you know, Sega had exclusive rights.
Mm-hmm.
And they really did a great job, I got to say. They honored that and they made it a real part of their primary lineup, and it was perceived as a Sega title, which we were very happy about. You know, you kind of want that as a developer. You want to be, have the picture of your title on the box.
Yeah.
And you want it to feel like it's a first party title. And that was all great. But the reason why a number of people had asked, you know, how did that happen? But it's really not that surprising. You just have to shift the context a little bit, because mm-hmm. when we made our deal with Sega, it was a different world back then.
Yeah.
You know, it was in 1990 when Sega of America was just getting started, and they were looking for ways to to make themselves visible. The big kid on the block, Nintendo, had all of the market share at the time here in the US, and they really wanted to get established, and they saw our property and our characters, which we brought to them pretty fully developed, as an opportunity. So that's kind of what gave us leverage. And in those kinds of rights discussions, that's really all it ever is. It's mm-hmm. kind of who wants what and who has the leverage. So
yep.
In those days, the balance was just kind of different than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So so it wasn't that weird back then.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, and again, that's another hour-long discussion, because it's very fascinating about that. I spoke with the guys from Farsight, who did the pinball arcade, and we had a whole discussion on the challenges of copyright and basically getting the ability to recreate or digitize classic pinball tables. And of course, there's GOG.com and the work that they do acquiring the rights to reproduce these classic games in a modern market. But again, that's all another, you know, hour-long discussion there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
All right. Yeah, and with that, I think we can move on and talk a little bit more about the Kickstarter. Again, it was such an interesting conversation with you, Greg, talking about the classic games and the work that goes into them. So let's move on and talk about what you're doing right now. And as we mentioned at the start of the cast, the Toe Jam and Earl Kickstarter for Back in the Groove is currently going on. You guys are over the halfway point for it. So I have a few just general questions that I ask developers about Kickstarter, and I have a few more specific ones for yours. So the first one then is, what was like the motivation to go onto Kickstarter now to hopefully get Toe Jam and Earl funded for the next game?
Oh, well, there's a few things. As I said in that intro video that some people may or may not have seen, Kickstarter sort of represented a path to making the game that I've wanted to make for years. And I maybe should say that Mark Vorsinger and I have wanted to make, except for the fact that he hasn't been making games for the last decade. He's kind of shifted direction in his career. So, mm-hmm. But, you know, we both of us back then, I'll just speak for him. We're still good friends, and he's a wonderful, wonderful guy who's very supportive of what I'm doing. Anyway, we both wanted to make the game we wanted to make. We wanted to make a real sequel to Game 1. Haven't been able to, and this seemed like it was going to be, if we could get funded, just the idea of, wow, this is kind of a new age. Kickstarter, nothing like this used to exist. Mm-hmm. It's possible now to make a game without a publisher. And that was part of the excitement and the drive behind doing it. Of course, a lot of ToeJam&Earl fans have been suggesting that for the last few years and asking, why aren't you doing a Kickstarter? Mm-hmm. And I think after I finished my last product for Sony, Doki Doki Universe, I just thought it might be exciting to kind of go indie a bit. You know, there's that's, as I'm sure you've been talking to a lot of people, Josh, in the indie scene.
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of a growing movement. Even within Sony, there's quite a strong indie spirit. They really have been courting indie developers, and even their in-house products like Doki Doki Universe mm-hmm. have a very strong indie flavor often. And so you know, it's kind of the dream of every developer to make the game you want to make in the way you want to make it without anybody telling you what to do. And even in the very best of cases, when you have the nicest people ever, and the people at Sony pretty much qualify for that. They're wonderful, wonderful, good-hearted people. Mm-hmm. Still, you know, it's still kind of a boss. You know, a boss. If they're paying you, you still got to be pleasing them. And you kind of want to just, there's nothing beats just sort of having the freedom to make your own game the way you want. So that's the indie dream. Mm-hmm. And we'll see, you know, every path has its own challenges and trials. And this is certainly not a slam dunk, you know, by any means. I'm having to work pretty hard, and the whole team here, mm-hmm. as it is, we're, you know, we're anxious and a little stressed out to see if this is all going to work, and trying to figure it out as we go. And then, of course, there's all the fans we want to please and make sure we're doing what they want and listening to all that feedback. And it's, you know, it's a different set of stresses than one has. And so far, I'm really enjoying it. And I'm hoping that we can get past this hurdle so I can sort of mm-hmm. enjoy the rest of indie development.
Yeah. You're not the only developer who's spoken about sort of the pressure and the challenges of running a Kickstarter campaign. We've spoken with several other developers who've, you know, shared their challenges with that. It really is a grueling pace. You know, you have to be on the Kickstarter almost day in, day out, you know, updating fans, keeping the news going, and really becomes almost like a side business you have to do for the 30 days, or even if some people do like 60 or 90 day Kickstarters. And I know there's a lot of preparation that goes into a Kickstarter campaign. Now, for you, Greg, and the rest of your studio, were there any, like, interesting studies or research that you did when you were coming up with the Kickstarter that maybe fans or people interested in Kickstarter would be interested in?
Studies or research in regards to, you mean ToeJam&Earl and its popularity, or you mean
or like the Kickstarter campaign itself, like setting it up, or how you were going to pitch the game, stuff like that?
Oh, nothing formal. You know, I mm-hmm. have quite a few friends in the game industry just because I've been around for so long, and a lot of them have done Kickstarters. So I was fortunate in that I had a bunch of people I could call on and ask for advice. So we did get a lot of advice and suggestions and warnings for what not to do. Even so much of it was just kind of figuring it out as we went along. I had never, mm-hmm. never tried to find manufacturing in China and figure out how to get toys designed and made and shipped to some fulfillment center, and how they're going to get shipped out to the people that want it and how that fulfillment center is supposed to get orders from Kickstarter and, you know, all the details of all of that. We just kind of have to, you just got to dive in and start figuring it out one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot to it.
I know. And I'm glad you brought up the manufacturing concerns, Greg, because that was actually my next question. One of the questions and comments I saw a lot of the Kickstarter backers ask was about the manufacturing of the physical goods. Because one thing that we've spoken to numerous developers about, and one thing that they all agree is a big no-no, is to say, don't have a lot of physical goods, because the shipping and the manufacturing costs can just kill you. Now, I know that you updated the FAQ for it to assure fans that that's been taken care of and factored into the price. And for people who haven't read that message or want to know a little bit more about those concerns, what have you guys done to assure fans that even though you have all these physical goods, their shipping and manufacturing won't be affecting the budget or the actual game product?
Oh, well, they will be affecting the budget. There is no way around that. It costs money. And but I frankly don't really even understand why people have run into so much trouble with that, because it can be expensive. But you just got to do some work up front and build spreadsheets and, you know, list out what all the costs are at each tier and make sure that your tiers are priced right and do the research with whoever's going to be handling the fulfillment and shipping and factor all those costs in. And we certainly did that. We have our spreadsheets and collected all the data and did our sort of cost analysis up front. And I worked hard to find a manufacturer that was inexpensive but still did good quality. Like the first place I went to, I won't say what they're called because maybe that's not nice, but they're a manufacturer here in the U.S. that does a lot of video game vinyl figures. Mm-hmm. Their cost was like 4 or 5 times the place I ended up finding in China to do it. And it can be prohibitively expensive, but you just got to find really good partners too. The place we're working with in Texas, Austin, called Amplifier. They seem great, and they're pretty inexpensive, and they're sort of a one-stop shop. They do the manufacturing of the shirts and the hoodies and the posters and the mugs, and they do the storing of everything and the fulfillment and the customer service all in one shot. So you can find some really good partners. I think what happens is a lot of people don't do their research, and then they try to save money by not having partners like that, and they do everything themselves, and they just get overwhelmed, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we tried to come up with a strategy too, where we could be kind of hands off. So that was one of the nice things about all of the physical goods that we have right now, is they get produced like in China and in Texas. They get shipped straight to the fulfillment center, and then they get shipped straight out to the backers. And we're working with a company called BackerKit. They collect all the data, and they work in conjunction with the fulfillment center, so that if backers want to change their order, their address changes, they want a different shirt size or whatever it is, or they want to do add-ons and order more of something, that all runs straight through BackerKit and into Amplifier, and we never have to do anything. So we can focus on building the game. In my mind, that's a risk. You hear people talk about the risk of the money, but what you don't hear much about is the energy and the time that it takes you to do all of that stuff yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what you want to do as a developer, especially if you're very small, like we are, is you want to offload it so that you can focus your energy on making the game.
Yeah, and definitely some really great points about that, Greg. And it sounds like you guys did the research. You didn't just, pick the first place on the list and say, okay, we're going to do them. You guys actually tracked them down, you looked into them, and figured that into the budget. And as you said, that could be one of the major stumbling blocks that a lot of developers who try to go down that road do. They try to do the whole thing themselves. We're going to print, manufacture, do all that. And as you said, it just is a lot of work. And it's better to give that to professionals who know what they're doing and, ease that burden or take that burden off of your shoulders.
Yeah, that's right. If you're running a very small campaign, like for, 10K or 15K and you've got a couple hundred backers, then maybe that works. But when you're up into thousands of backers, then it just very quickly becomes kind of untenable to do that yourself, and you kind of need partners like that.
Yeah. Now, I have one other question about the manufacturing. This is probably a very stupid question, but I'm just curious for my own information. With, like, the shirts, the figures, and all that, were, like, the actual concepts, did you and your studio come up with them? Or did you consult with the manufacturer and they sort of, like, drew up the concepts and then you approved them?
You know, it can work either way. Okay. So, you know, I'm sure people have done it both ways. In this case, we did the artwork and gave it to them. I think, you know, that's often much more efficient when you're working with some company that's overseas.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's much harder to have a tight communication loop with someone in China than down the down the street, right? But yeah, that's what we did. And in fact, with the vinyl figures, which seem to be the most popular of the rewards that we're offering, mm-hmm. All we did was I gave them some artwork. In fact, we weren't sure, by the way, as an aside, whether or not I wasn't sure whether or not to go with the old school designs for the characters, like from game one, mm-hmm. or the new designs, you know, from, you know, back in the groove. Or I had a third set of kind of stylized vinyl figures. Sometimes you'll see vinyl figures when they're very simple and roundy with big heads and stuff like that. And I had those done up by an artist friend of mine, too. So I had these three sets and I wasn't sure what to do. And then I finally decided that the fans would probably like the real old school game one style. So I sent these drawings off to this company in China, just 2D drawings of the characters. And they totally blew me away when they sent me back photos of these clay sculptures that they had done of them. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's perfect. That's what they look like. So they had some very talented artists out there at this company. And so I've been very happy. They've been so nice and fast, responsive, cheap. If anybody ever needs vinyl toys made in quantity, because that's another thing, you know, you can't just go and order, you know, a dozen of these things. They're usually, you need thousands of them at a minimum order. Usually, I think the minimum order is 3,000. In fact, that company I mentioned in the U.S., mm-hmm. that was another reason why I didn't go with them. Because they had a minimum order of 10,000 units.
Oh, damn. You
know, wouldn't even talk to me if I couldn't order that. Those kind of numbers. So
awesome. Yeah. And as I said on the spotlight, I gotta ask if you have any extra vinyl figures or swag at the end, as I would love to have some.
Oh yeah, right. Well, we'll see. I don't know. I have no idea. You know, I may end up with thousands of these if we don't meet our ask for getting funded. I'm going to end up with a ton of these. So you're welcome. Welcome, Josh, to have some of that. Because I went ahead. It was a little risky. I spent my own money, you know, some of my savings, because I wanted one to have these to show people, because I figured it'd be more appealing if people could see it. So I had to get that process actually started in order to have them to show. And I also, there's very long lead times with these things. You know, it can be sometimes 6 months or even longer before you get the toys actually back and ready to ship. And I didn't want people to have to wait that long. So I just went ahead and had them start their manufacturing. So we've got them. They're already in the works now. So hopefully we'll get funded and then I'll be able to ship them out and people won't have to wait too long.
Yeah. Yeah, I do wish you the best of luck on that. And yeah, any spare ones, I'd love to have them. I have a bunch of Nintendo Amiibo, so it'd be awesome to have them next to each other. Yeah, nice. My own little figurine cabinet there.
Oh, excellent.
All right. Two more quick Kickstarter general questions, and then we'll move on to our final topic. Okay, the first one then is, this is another question, well, sort of one I like to ask a lot of our developers who come on. And you sort of talked about this a few minutes ago, but I just want to clarify for people listening. What are your overall impressions of Kickstarter and crowdfunding in general? Because as we talked about, you worked as a major studio, you worked with AAA with Sega. What are your thoughts on this model, having made that shift from the AAA to the indie market?
Oh, well, I think it's a great thing, just as the bottom line. I can talk more about the ups and downs. Like everything, there are, you know, ups and downs, good things and not so good things, or things at least that are difficult or challenging if you've got a positive spirit and you can look at it that way. But the bottom line is, I think it's great in that it represents a really, really positive opportunity for people to get started. I think there's no question that so many people have taken advantage of it already and have gotten off and into the air with projects that they couldn't have launched otherwise. And not just getting funded, there's still an awful lot more to it than that in terms of the benefits that you get. We already talked about the you know, the connection that you get to make with the backers and the fans. That's huge. There's also just the exposure that you get by virtue of being on Kickstarter. So I think there's a lot of benefits to it. And, you know, even from this side, just the benefit of having the experience of doing it in and of itself is worth a lot. I never would have made a music video, you know, or taken my camera and gone into Tim Schafer and Will Wright and Paul Ritchie and Fred Ford's office and had them act as goofy as they did if it wasn't for this Kickstarter, and or learned about manufacturing and toys and made some really good friends in China now who I we send photos back and forth of our families and course on now. And where I'm talking to these guys. I was Skyping the other day with this group in Brazil. They're called the Game Boys. And some fan pointed me at their YouTube video of Toe Jam and Earl music that they were playing. And they were really good. And so I contacted them and said, hey, do you guys think you might be interested in working with me on some music? No commitments, but like to get to know them. And they were thrilled, and it's just like, it's endless. The number of new people I've met and the experiences that I've had as a result of this. So there's no question that it's been worthwhile. And even if we don't fund, it's still no regrets at all. It's still worth having done. It's, it's been a great, great experience. Now, all that said, it is stressful, and there is an awful lot of work involved that you have to do coming up to it. You know, just building the prototype all by itself and trying to get that ready and scramble. We were working day and night for that, and then, you know, trying to arrange the video shoot, and we did a music video, and I got, you know, worked with an animator to get the animated one done, and all of the toys and the t-shirts and the fulfillment and the backer kit, and on and on and on. I have to stop myself because the list of stuff we had to do in preparation of this was just crazy, you know. And it's all new. And then I thought, oh, well, at least once this starts, things will cool down a little bit because I won't have to do all that preparatory stuff. Yeah. And little did I know, you know, you open the doors and whoa, and there's this flood that comes rushing in those doors as you're sort of breathing in to relax. And you're just like overrun by all of the response that you get. And, you know, it's like, you know, 1,000 people all wanting to talk to you all at the same time, fans and interviewers and everything. And you're trying to figure out, everybody's saying, this is wrong or that's wrong, and you should be doing this, and you should be doing that. And you're scrambling now because you're totally in the public eye and you're trying to fix everything all at once and figure out what questions you need to answer and which ones you don't in what order. It's just, you know, I've been working like 14, 16-hour days on the weekends too. I just don't go home anymore because this has been so intense. So that's not complaining, you know. It sounds a little bit like it, but I'm enjoying it, and it's been, like I said, a lot of fun and very worthwhile, but it is, you got to kind of be ready for it. So kind of a word of warning to anyone who is going to step into this, it's pretty intense, and or it can be, you know. That's good. You know, I imagine some Kickstarters maybe they're sitting around waiting for the phone to ring and nothing's happening, and that's a lot worse than having a like what we're doing is where it's just like crazy intense. But
I know. And as a quick aside with that, I know your Kickstarter for Toe Jam Earl was set for 30-day. I've seen people do like 60 and 90-day campaigns. I just can't imagine, you know, sustaining all that energy and enthusiasm for, you know, 2-3 months of content. It just seems mind-boggling. And I think it was a good idea that you kept it to 30 days, especially what you've been saying with this cast. I bet you would go nuts if you had to do this for another 30 or 60 more days.
Yeah, I don't understand that either, frankly, but I think it must have to do with what, assuming that they're being smart and strategic about that. I'm sure some people just don't know and they just close their eyes and hit the button. But I'm sure a lot of people are doing that intentionally, and maybe they just want to be out. Maybe they're doing it for exposure and they want to be out in the public eye longer or something. I don't know. You know, in fact, with that in mind, one of the downsides to Kickstarter is that a lot of people do it for exposure. They don't really do it for the money. Mm-hmm. And especially in the games, people are doing it to get funded for games. A lot of these people are already funded or mostly funded, and they just want they want to get the game out there. What ends up happening as a result is they set their stretch goals at very small amounts because they don't really need the money. And sometimes young indie developers who are inexperienced, they'll set their stretch goals very low too, just because they want it to be appealing and they don't really know what the costs are going to be. And then what ends up happening is that audience out there, backers, who, you know, they have no reason why they should know what things cost. They just look at other Kickstarter campaigns and go, oh, okay, oh, that costs an extra $5,000 to do another platform or something. And they get that expectation. And maybe that developer, they didn't really need the money because they're already funded. Now, all of a sudden, the people that are out there who are looking for that money because they really need it to do these things, there's an expectation that's kind of unrealistic amongst the Kickstarter backers. And that's that can be difficult being on the other side of that, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's just something to keep in mind, I guess, the way one of the pitfalls of Kickstarter and other crowdsource funding.
Yeah, definitely. And again, another great topic which we could embellish on for who knows how long. But I know we are getting a little bit late in terms of the cast, so let's move on and talk briefly about Into the Groove. Obviously, we can't get into too much detail because, of course, the game isn't being made at the moment. But we can at least talk a little bit about what you hopefully have in mind for it, and then we will wrap things up.
Okay.
So over the cast, we've talked about your time in the industry, we've talked about the previous Toe Jam and Earl games, and of course we've spent some time on the Kickstarter. So my next question then for you, Greg, is for people listening, what is Toe Jam and Earl Back in the Groove about?
Oh, well, when you say what's it about, that's kind of suggestive of the story or the backstory. Mm-hmm. Some games are more about story than other games, you know. And so when you're describing sort of what a game is, for those games, it's kind of appropriate to start there and talk about the story. But there is a story in Toe Jam and Earl, kind of a backstory, and I could talk about that, happy to. But that's not really what the heart of this game is. The heart of this game and what I'm shooting for has more to do with the play and the play mechanics and the cooperative play, kind of taking Toe Jam and Earl 1, that experience. And the first step is basically just kind of rebuilding that and re-realizing it with, you know, new music and new graphics and taking some of the mechanics that were from Panic on Funkatron and building them into, you know, the Toe Jam and Earl 1 style of rogue play. And also, frankly, taking some of the stuff out of Game 3 and building that in, too. And then from there, I want to expand, and I've got a long list of game features, of new features that I'm hoping to do That will depend in large part on how well we fund, because it just takes time, you know, to do all of that stuff. And especially new things require more time to iterate and try, because you can't be as sure of them if it's new. So we'll just have to see how far we can get with all of that. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed that our funding will, you know, obviously that we'll fund, but also that maybe we'll even get a little bit of headroom so that I can try a bunch of these new things that I'm really excited about.
Okay. Now, on the Kickstarter page, you mentioned some of the interesting mechanics or new features that you're hoping. Some of the ones that I saw were like four-player online co-op. I think you were talking about having like a light RPG progression system in there in terms of altering stats. Are there any other like interesting new features that you can share with the fans listening?
Let's see. Well, yes, sure. Just keep in mind that right now it's just kind of a list, and I don't know. I haven't really prioritized it. And when you do game development, one of the very first things you do is you spew out all the ideas you want, and then you put them down in front of the engineer and you say, please do a technical assessment for each one of these things. You know, what are the potential problems, and how long do you think this roughly will take, and what resources will we need, right? So we haven't done any of that yet.
Okay.
So that's another thing that it's hard, a little hard for backers to understand, you know, and that's in some ways it's easier when you're working with publishers, because they kind of know that process. And a backer will say, oh, but wait, you said this on the page. You said you promised. And you're like, well, no, I mentioned that as a possibility in an interview. But anyway, enough caveats. One of the things that we, one of the things I'm excited about is day and night cycles. We had that in game three, and it was kind of fun. You know, boogeymen and cow ghosts come out at nighttime, and you can have, you know, torches and campfire presence. And in the old Rogue game, darkness was kind of a fun thing to have, where you could walk around and, you know, it's a little more exciting and tense. And we're going to have hidden objects in this game. In game three, we did that too, but we didn't have it in game one, where things were just hidden all around. And they're going to sort of sparkle at night, and you have kind of a sixth sense, so that when you get near one, you kind of can hear a little something. It'll be kind of subtle and see a little something, but they're easier to see at nighttime. And and we're also going to probably do the hidden objects inside of bushes and trees, just like we had in game two. You know, and that'll all be part of the skills that you'll have. Characters will have different attributes. So, you know, you'll be better at hiding and better at having a sixth sense, so that you can tell where things are. Oh, here's a fun idea in regards to those player stats. And this actually didn't come from me. It came from a podcast I did early on with two really nice guys, Zach Smith and Dana, his brother. And I think it was Dana who suggested the idea of a self-control stat for characters, so that if you have a low self-control, you can't help it, and you just sort of open presents at random sometimes. And I thought that was really funny. I wrote that down. I think I want to do that as part of it too. That's cute.
Yeah. Now, when we talked about the original Toe Jam and Earl with the rogue elements to it, and as you said, it had set of 25 levels which had randomly generated elements. With Back in the Groove, are you going to stick to having like a quote unquote like set a number of levels for a single playthrough, or will it be more randomly generated, like more of a roguelike?
We're going to do both, is the plan.
Okay.
So we'll have a set number of randomly generated levels, and probably it'll just be 25, because that's kind of the magic number from game one, although that conceivably could change. And then I'm excited about the idea of sort of going back to rogue roots too, and having a infinite play mode that gets unlocked after you've played the game a certain number of times.
Okay.
And then it's just like, you don't know how far it goes. And in this case, of course, you're going up instead of down into a dungeon. Mm-hmm. And And I want to be able to have surprises too, like pretty deep in, so that people can sort of speculate about what's further and sort of compare how far they've gone. And another fan recommended that we have sort of a leaderboard that sort of people can compare how far they've gotten and other aspects of how many presents they've collected and, you know, a variety of things like that, which I think would be a lot of fun too. I'm not quite sure how we'll do that. I have a lot of things on my list that have question marks next to them, where, you know, you just think, Oh, that's fun. I don't know if that's possible, but we'll see. So that's one of those things.
Yeah, man. I would really love to, like, sit here and chat with you for the next hour about the design, but of course, we don't know, or you don't know specifically, what's going to make it in. And of course, everything is subject to change once you start sitting down and trying to put it to the computer.
Yeah, that's very true. I know we can go through all of the things that are possible, and I bet you'll have a bunch of ideas too that I'm, you know, that I would write down as add to my list. But yeah, until we, you know, we have to figure out quite honestly, in a very pragmatic sense, what our budget is. You need to kind of know what your resources are, and you need to be very realistic about scoping so that you can plan. Like if we had enough of a budget, if we end up with a budget where we can hire two or three engineers, we can do a lot more of what's on my list than if we end up building with just the one engineer that actually right at the moment, it seems most likely that we're just going to stay really, really small. So I'm kind of steeling myself right now to have to make some difficult decisions because, of course, as the designer, I want it all.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to prioritize. And then you do time estimates next to each thing, and then you draw a line across that spreadsheet as to this is how far we're going to be able to get with the amount of time and our budget. And you got to make sure you have, headroom in there for all of the things that you don't anticipate, because that's inevitable when you're building a game.
Yeah. So
that's the way it works.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Now, one point that I do want to ask you about, Greg, and this is one thing that I saw a lot of people also comment on the Kickstarter about, is the art aesthetic that you're going with. As we said at the beginning with the original Toe Jam and Earl, it had, you know, a very unique look with the alien designs and the music. I know some people were having questions about how the early prototype was looking. I know you guys put up like another model or another scale rendering of what you're hoping the art will look like in the full version. Has there been any more work or development, or have you nailed down the art aesthetic for in Back in the Groove?
Oh, yeah. Well, that continues, and it will as we continue the project. It was never really... That's another another pitfall with Kickstarter, as I'm sure you can imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, different people who go onto Kickstarter and put up their games come at it from a whole wide variety of financial situations where sometimes they've been able to get halfway through their game. Maybe sometimes even I've even seen Kickstarters where they're like almost finished with the game and they put it up there. And then other times people will put up a very early prototype. And in our case, that's all, you know, I've been funding this out of my savings. And we would have loved to get farther down the road before we put it up on Kickstarter, but we just couldn't afford to. We had to kind of go up now and because we need the development money. So you don't really have a chance to ever say that on Kickstarter, mm-hmm. you know, and you don't want to sound like you're making too many excuses for what you're showing. So, but the truth is that was early. We had a lot of work to do still on refining the look. I wasn't even totally sure what I wanted. It was an opportunity and a good one to get feedback from the fans and to hear what they wanted. So I see that as a really positive thing. Some changes are easy. You know, people said, it seems too dull. Can you make it brighter and more saturated? And that was a matter of like 10 minutes. You know, we're like, sure, that's easy. And in fact, yeah, good point. I think I agree with that. Let's do that. And then there's a lot of fans who are sort of purists and just want the old game exactly like it was. And they're like, why does it have to look any different from the old game? Why don't you just res it up and give us that? And for that, All I can say is, well, that's not what we're doing. I don't want to do just an exact redo of game one. Game one exists out there. If people want that, they can still go buy it and today on Xbox and on PlayStation and Wii. I want to bring some fresh life to it and take a slightly different angle on it. And I managed to find a really talented young artist, Nathan Shorts. This is from the San Francisco Academy of Art, and he does this sort of old retro-y 1990s comic book style art, which I just thought was perfect. I love it. One of the things the fans didn't really like, and I think a lot of people actually like that from what I've heard in the feedback, the main criticism that we got was people felt like the 2D sprites didn't really work so well on the 3D terrain because you could see that they were flat a lot of the times. You know, the game one sprites were the same thing. They were same flat 2D sprites, and you never saw them from the side, so you never noticed that. If even though the world is 3D, if you don't move the camera, you don't know that they're flat. It is true that we're doing the black outlines, which has a comic booky style, so that can kind of flatten things a bit. But nevertheless, it was mainly because we were moving the camera all around, and that was just because we could in Unity. It was easy to do, and we thought, oh, that's kind of exciting. It'll let the people see more of the world, you know, quickly, because you got to show it in just like 2 minutes. So we did that, and we didn't have time. Basically, what you would normally you would do is you would code all the sprites so that they're always facing the camera, no matter where you move the camera, and we just didn't have time to do that. So we thought, oh, well, it's just a prototype. People will understand. You know? Yeah. Okay, lesson learned.
yeah. All right. And again, we could sit here and probably talk for a few more hours about it, but I have just a few more general wrap-up questions for you, Greg, and then we will say our goodbyes.
Okay.
So I guess the big one then is, what is your like time frame if you do get the funding for when In the Groove will be released, or if you have any thoughts or planning on that at the moment?
Oh, I know everybody wants an answer to that question. It depends on it depends on the budget that we have to work with to a large extent, because we have to plan. As soon as we get as soon as we know what we're working with, then we create a schedule for ourselves, and we list out in detail all the things we're going to try to do and when we're going to try to get them done by. Until we do that, it's just pulling a number out of the air, you know. Yeah. It doesn't mean that much. I can say that it's will be probably not less than a year, and probably not more than 2 years. So it's somewhere in that range of 1 to 2 years. And if we end up just getting our just meeting the bar and not going much above it, then it'll be shorter, you know, because it'll just have to get done faster. So it'll be a smaller game, and we just won't get as much in, and we'll try to get done sooner, so before we run out of money.
And I know on the Kickstarter page, your stretch goals, you have the console stretch goals in there. In terms of for the PC, are you planning on getting on Steam or GOG or any other digital stores to sell the game?
I don't know. We are talking to Humble Bundle, and I'm pretty sure we're going to go with them. I have a few friends that work there. So good relationship with them, and they've been so nice and welcoming to us. I can't see not doing that. I think I haven't actually talked to the people at Steam yet, but I don't think there are any barriers to that. We've just been assuming we would be probably on Steam in conjunction with Humble Bundle, but nothing really definite yet.
Okay. Sounds great, Greg. And again, I know we've been rushing through this, and for those of you listening, I know it sucks that we're not spending too much time on everything, but I don't want to keep Greg too long, because again, he is hard at work with this Kickstarter. But yeah, it would be a pleasure to have you back on, because I mean, we have so many different avenues for other conversations, not just about Back in the Groove, but just about your time in the game industry and just design in general.
Yeah, that's well, it's nice of you to say that, Josh. It's kind of funny because I feel like I'm talking your ear off, but and it's hard to imagine people want to hear me talk this much about all this stuff, but I'm happy to talk about it, and there is you know, there's a lot of topics within the game industry to talk about, so I'm happy to come back.
Yeah, and I know you probably think this cast is going on for a very long time, but we've actually had like 2 and 3 hour casts with developers sometimes.
Wow.
When we just get on like a lot of topics. But I know with the Kickstarter, I didn't want to keep you till like 10 o'clock at night, at least 10 o'clock at night my time.
Oh, thanks. That is very thoughtful of you, Josh. I appreciate that.
All right. So with everything said, for right now to wrap things up with, my final question for you, Greg, is do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to say to the fans listening to the cast?
Oh, yeah, well, this might sound trite, but I do really mean it. This has been an amazing experience for me, and I just want to just say thank you to everybody who has even just listened to this podcast. That's really nice of you. I'm sorry if it's been me, if I've been rambling about stuff. I am blown away by the amount of support and enthusiasm and what people have been doing just to kind of going out and doing flyers, making videos of themselves, sharing all of their ideas endlessly with me of how we can do a better job and succeed at this. And man, you know, sometimes you think of the internet as a scary place. There's a lot of negativity out there on the internet, but I've seen very, very little of it in this campaign with Kickstarter. It's been exactly the opposite, just this like this flow of positive feelings and support and stuff, and it's been really, really great. I've been trying to sort of share that with the rest of the team and also with Mark Vorsanger, because I'm sort of the front man, and I kind of get all of that. and I also feel like I just want to say it's not just me by any means, both having made Toe Jam and Earl, you know, all those years ago. Mark Vorsanger deserves a big, you know, heartfelt appreciation for all of the stuff that he put into that. And then on this project, the people that I'm working with are just kind of working behind the scenes and working their butts off, pouring their hearts into it. So it's not just me. And I want to just ask people to go back and we've been updating a lot on our Kickstarter page. So if you haven't seen it recently, go check it out. And we're going to keep putting stuff up. We've got new content, new videos and stuff. And one of the things I feel personally like is it's all part of the same thing. I'm in this industry to entertain people and make them smile and laugh. And so I wanted to make a Kickstarter campaign that would do that, not just ask for money, but be a place people could go just to enjoy some nostalgia and some music videos and some fun animation and stuff like that. So I hope people will enjoy the page and just come. You don't have to back. It's fine, you know. Just leave a comment, a little, you know, a thought or two, and that's plenty. It's appreciated. So that's about it.
Awesome. Yep. Great words to end the cast on, Greg. And if I didn't say at the start, I do wish you guys the best of luck. As I said, Toe Jam and Earl was one of my favorite games growing up, and hopefully we can have you back on after the Kickstarter is a success and talk more about the design.
Yeah, well, as you can see, I have no problem rattling on. You throw me a question, and you got to tell me to shut up. So I'm happy to talk about whatever, you know, whatever you want to talk about.
Awesome. All right. With that, we are going to wrap up the cast for tonight. Again, Greg, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And as I said, we definitely need to have you back on because there's just so many more topics to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, Josh. This has been fun.
Awesome. So for those of you listening, thanks for tuning in to the Perceptive Podcast this week. Make sure to check out Greg's Kickstarter. There will be links to it in the podcast notes below. And as always, If you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, there are several options available. For submitting guest pieces or being a future guest on these podcasts, you can find all the information and links under the Submissions Wanted link on the front page. And to contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign, you can find all that information under the Patreon banner also on the front page. And make sure to check out my Twitch channel and YouTube page, where I'll be playing games and talking about them critically. You can find the Twitch channel under my handle, GWBicer, on Twitch. And there's also a link to the YouTube page from there. So, thanks again for watching. Again, make sure to check out the Kickstarter, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.